Hey everyone, welcome to Investing Counterpoint. And today we're talking about the recent cuts from OPEC and what effect they're going to have on the global economy. We believe that it's not going to have a big effect on the global economy, but there's a real potential for a black swan type of event coming from these cuts. We're going to tell you how and why in this episode. I'm Jan Perillo, CEO of Rextrema, and today I have my colleague and co-founder of Rextrema, Daniel Sachkov. Daniel, how are you doing today?
I'm doing well. Hi, everyone. A black swan event coming from oil, huh?
Well, black swan, you know, it's been used so many times. And if we're talking about it and talking about how it can happen, it's not really a black swan. But in this case, I think that we might actually be talking about a black swan because it's really not going to be something that we're going to be able to plan for. Just to recap, we know that OPEC has made two rounds of cuts recently in the past 6 or 8 months to the amount of oil that they're supplying to the market. And I think it totals 3.5 million barrels over the past 6 months. And so the thought is like, oh my God, they can't do this because
over the past 6 months or over the next 6 months?
Well, they've made the cuts over the past 6 months, which will take place, you know, so they say, okay, we're cutting supply and they're supposed to reduce their output by 2 million barrels. And now they're supposed to, you know, reduce it by 1.5 million barrels. So for the next, you know, going forward, that's what they're going to do. They're going to make those cuts. So they announce the cuts and then they make, and this is OPEC Plus, which is, you know, we'll go over that a little bit, who OPEC is. But really, the idea is they make the cuts and they prop up the price of oil. And so, you know, Saudi Arabia in particular, which pumps oil for, I don't remember what the exact per barrel price is, but it's really low. The cost of oil for Saudi Arabia is extremely low. So $80 a barrel is very profitable for the Saudis. So they have an interest in keeping it high. You know, when we in the West look at Saudi Arabia or OPEC, I should say, cutting, we're thinking, well, they're trying to keep our inflation high and trying to really do some damage to the economy. And so OPEC is this cartel, and there's been this talk of breaking OPEC. You know, what if, you know, we don't allow cartels in almost anything, although I should say, we say we don't allow cartels in anything, but in some, you know, we certainly have some business monopolies and things like that. But OPEC is explicitly a cartel making choices on really forcing the supply and demand equation of oil. So OPEC has a lot of power. And what I want to look at first is I want to look at the reaction to the OPEC price, the OPEC cuts. The OPEC cuts are something that is, you know, very important for oil. So here we have the oil prices here. This is just over the last, you know, year or so. And what we can see is that, you know, oil prices were certainly falling dramatically into the first OPEC cut. Remember, this is a $2 million barrel cut. And we had an increase in oil prices of about 16% after that cut. And then you can see what happened, kind of just dropped off, came back up, and then started to fall again. Now, this could be looked at as demand is not strong enough and there's still more supply. So everybody knows that we're having, you know, inflationary issues. We're talking, you know, there's a lot of talk about recessions, a lot of talk about, you know, how healthy the global economy is. We usually look at this from a U.S. standpoint, but there's a whole, you know, oil is truly a global commodity, obviously. And so what is the global effect? What are other countries? What's happening in Europe? What's happening, you know, in Russia, Ukraine? I mean, all these conflicts impact us. So we see oil prices really starting to fall here below $70 and then back up when OPEC made this cut.
And the last leg up, I think, was the China kind of continuing to reopen, but also making the monetary conditions easier. I think they reduced some reserve requirements for banks and so on and so forth. So it's kind of China driven right there.
I would agree with that. And we're going to talk a little about China in just a moment. But I mean, that's exactly right. And then you see the impact, and it's a 6% impact. That number in red there might be hard to see, but it's a 6% impact most recently on the price of oil. And, you know, this was a couple of days ago, but it fluctuated around, but it's really kind of stuck at $80. We haven't seen the same impact from this cut that we saw earlier, that we saw back in October. So the supply cut hasn't had the same impact, even though it's on top of an already 2 million barrel cut in daily oil supply. So it's another 1.5 million. And the market has kind of said, you know, they obviously reacted, but not in a big way like they did before. The price of oil has kind of stuck around $80, you know, give or take for the last few days. So let's talk real quickly about who OPEC are, who they are. And you know, I want to do this because I was a little bit surprised by this. So this is 2022 crude oil production, and these are the percentages. So it's not barrels, but the percentage of global oil production. When you look at OPEC share as the global supplier, It's only 34% of all global production, which is, you know, I mean, so roughly a third is OPEC. And I was kind of surprised to see how much the U.S. produces relative to OPEC, you know, 20% versus all this massive, you know, cartel getting together and making these agreements. You know, we produce, you know, 20%, you know, not quite, you know, more than 50% of the OPEC share. But what happens is we get OPEC plus, right? We get Russia, which this number is down from previous years because of the war. We get Russia, Kazakhstan, and Mexico, I think are the big ones in there. I can't remember if Brazil is in OPEC plus. But look at what these countries are. They're all here in the Middle East and Africa, right? As well as Venezuela. So we have these production. And by the way, you know, here's a nice history of it. This has been pretty stable for the last 3 years, you know, this is the expected percentage going forward. So this is not a dramatic change in the share of OPEC oil being produced. What's going to happen with this? What do we think is going to happen with this? Why do we think there can be a black swan event? Well, one of the things I think is that the Middle East is always a volatile place. Think about Iran, Israel right now. I mean, you know, think about Iran and anyone. Think about Israel and anyone. We have tensions with Syria and Israel. We have tensions with the Palestinians. Anything that happens, like an attack a few years ago of, you know, Iran on the Saudi refinery, can have a massive impact on something. It was kind of shrugged off because we had plenty of supply and it wasn't that big of an attack. But if there's an attack on some of the production in a big way, we can have that's where that black swan event can really come in. If there's an escalation in tensions in the Middle East, if there's a war breaking out between, you know, Iran and Saudi Arabia in some way, if Iran tries to, you know, take over Iraq or Iraq tries to take over Kuwait, which won't happen right now, but there's so much in this system. You know, Libya is a OPEC producer. If something happens with Libya and Israel, there could be a big disruption in the system for this. And there's actually quite a few ways that I think that disruptions can happen. I mean, what do you think about these?
Well, I think that Iran and Iraq they're on the same team now. It's a little bit different than under Saddam.
A little bit different than
they're mostly the Shia countries. I think, yeah, it's certainly, you have to add into the picture the fact that Israel's government right now is the most extreme government that it's ever had, I think, or close to it. And it's quite belligerent. And at any point, it could start hostilities. I mean, Iran is not exactly the Ayatollahs are not kind of the most peaceful government on earth either. So you have two highly, I would say, belligerent countries with very deep animosity and serious conflicts, right? For example, Israel believes that Iran can come close to developing nuclear weapons, which would be, for Israel, kind of the biggest threat in the world. I mean, yep. It would be bigger than the World War III in some sense. Because World War III could take place without affecting Israel in a huge way, whereas Iran having nukes, you know, is a direct, changes the game forever. I will say that one thing that's interesting about this region is that the last 6 months, I got really interested in Iranian revolution. Mm-hmm. I studied it very carefully. I read a bunch of books. I watched everything I could on the topic because it's fascinating to me. I realized that Iranian revolution was kind of a very new kind of a revolution where it was, believe it or not, it was mostly peaceful, where Ayatollah Khomeini was able from abroad to displace the Shah, with Shah being kind of a main U.S. ally, supposedly. Yeah. And the story was that, you know, it was these Islamists, you know, extreme Islam that displaced the Shah and created this Muslim Republic, right? Which is a new concept in itself, Islamic Republic. No, but the history didn't know such a concept. Khomeini was such an unbelievably skilled politician. He developed a whole new ideology that was able to go across the class lines, across the ideology lines. He'd even captured some people who were fairly liberal, who would not agree to what transpired later. The whole point of me saying this is that I realized after studying this, the Shah fell with actually United States government took a lot of steps to ensure that he falls. It's actually shocking to me. In the U.S. government, there were quite a few people who believed that Khomeini was going to be a moderate ruler and that we could deal with him. It's true. It's only after the fact when they took the U.S. hostages and the whole thing transpired that he became kind of the enemy number one, as he should. But in the run-up to this, Shah requested a lot of very specific support. And there were factions in U.S. government that turned them down. But the reason I believe, and many historians agree, is that the Shah, remember, in the Iran, in the Shah, in the time of the Shah, he was an ally, but he was also he viewed himself as an independent ruler. And he was trying to keep the cartel. He was the leader in the cartel. He was trying to raise the price of oil, the Shah right. was. And there was a meeting, I believe, with Kissinger. Saudi Arabia was the one who, behind the scenes, like, that was a very interesting story. There was some U.S., I forgot he was ambassador, I will refresh my memory, but it was a U.S. functionary who spoke with Shah. And I don't know if it's true that Shah said this or it was a lie, but he went and told Saudi Arabia that the Shah spoke about invading Saudi Arabia and taking over. And at the time, they were just up in arms and they were like, and they wanted to really go after him. So the goal of the Saudi Arabia was to weaken support of the United States for Shah. And they went, and there was a big meeting, I think it was 76 or something like that, big meeting of the cartel. And in the meeting, Shah and the countries that followed him said, no, we're not increasing the output. We're not reducing the price, because United States wanted him to sell oil. I forgot what it was, like $8 or something. I mean, he was like, they would make very little money. Essentially, they were a colony. And Shah said, you don't understand. You know, we need money too. And right. And then when he raised the price, they told him there was all this negative press in the United States and they were keep beating him down, basically setting him up for fall in the U.S. And he had this passionate speech where he read off all of the commodities they buy from the United States. Remember, this is 1970s. Mm-hmm. This is a relevant period. This is a period very similar to today. High inflation, supply shocks, geopolitical instability. Now, the only thing that's different is that there was no such large debt. And so he read a list of all the things he buys from the U.S. And he said, this rose 40%. This rose 50% in price. So you keep raising the prices on us. And yet when we try to raise the prices a little bit, you call us price gougers and like basically I'm not an ally anymore and so on. But the oil interest in U.S. government essentially ensured that the Shah fell. In the critical moment, they did not give him support. And then when basically Khomeini was very, very wise, he forbade, I mean, if you think about how Islamic Republic of Iran turned out, it would be pretty surprising for you to know that Shah had, you know, pretty brutal police. I mean, I think he was a progressive ruler, but, you know, he had a very brutal police and they would beat up these protesters and demonstrations. And Khomeini was actually, every time he would step out and say, be peaceful. They hit you, they break your bones, don't respond, be peaceful. So he was like this Gandhi-like figure. He was very, very wise of him. So even in the Islamist movement, many of them were against Khomeini. They're like, this guy doesn't allow us to hit back. He's like a Gandhi, he will lose everything. But he was very smart. He kept basically saying that we're going to be peaceful. They're just going to punish us. We're going to be peaceful, blah, blah, blah. And at the same time, when already the strikes broke out and everything crippled Iran's oil production, U.S. general came to Iran and started meeting with the members of the military who were all loyal. They were all loyal to the Shah. So like Iran was not a banana republic. They were actually real loyal military. They had an ideology, and U.S. general was meeting with generals, and they're not speaking with Shah, but meeting with them directly. It was a signal that basically you're done. And so Shah fell, but ironically, he fell for basically having a cartel and raising the price of oil. And Saudi Arabia was the one that was against the strike breaker, right? There was price breakers. They said, we'll sell as low as necessary. And that's where it comes in, where you said, their cost was very low, so they could afford it. So essentially, Saudi Arabia destroyed the Iranian monarchy. And now it's a very different story. I think that it shows that the influence of the United States in the world is waning, because Saudi Arabia would not do this now, because this is a very bad timing for the U.S. to increase the price of oil, what they're trying to do, right? They would not do it now if they were afraid of the repercussions. So we'll see how this plays out. But last time this happened, Shah, like a major ruler, lost power because of the oil dispute.
Well, we started to see some disruption, some unrest in Iran lately. I think it's cooled down quite a bit, but you know, that could be a kettle waiting to burst too. So, I mean, if there's something in Iran, you know, that's one of the things I have on this list here of potential black swans. I mean, if Iran has this massive political upheaval, which is possible, I think it's, you know, because there is unrest in Iran, that could cause some sort of supply disruption. I mean, I don't know how similar that is to the 70s, because I haven't studied that, you know, that revolution like you have. But, there was a disruption in Iran, certainly, which certainly caused a spike. And like you said, Saudi Arabia this time is not going to be the one that says, OK, well, we'll just, really increase the production to make up for it. They might just let it go. And so that could be a real, real shock. And that could really shock the system and the global economy into, that could be the straw that breaks the camel back into recession.
The other thing that my observation that is surprising me is that during the inflation run up, I mean, we've seen a lot of the commodities go up. Yes, some of them went down in price after a run up. But overall, when you have inflationary expectations, you would think that over the last year, oil would do more. And in the 70s, when you had these kinds of, I mean, clearly we have supply shocks now. Even sanctions on Russia are supply shock, right? And then so on and so forth. So why isn't the oil doing more?
Well, I would argue that this
hypothesis, tell me what you think.
No, go ahead. Go finish your hypothesis.
And write in the comments, please, what you think. Why didn't the oil go up over the last year when we had inflation? My hypothesis is that generally deep down in the market, because of all this debt, incredible debt overhang over the world economy in the United States, there's a general belief that we're going to enter some major recession or depression. Somewhere in the back of the mind that we keep delaying it, but the reckoning will come. And somehow people just don't think the oil will be needed. Like, you don't need, in a major recession, you don't drive. you don't do anything.
I kind of think it's more because, despite all the sanctions, Russia oil still made it to the market. I mean, nothing prevented Russia from supplying oil to China, to India, because
it's
they-
true, yeah, it. But it's only like 11%, right? Why, I was thinking if there's a big inflationary pressure on oil, it would, you would think you would get to $100 at least over the past year, because there was a lot of...
Yeah, I just don't think there was a demand or a supply disruption at all, even though it was supposed to be, because it still made it to the market. It still made it at a lower price because we put major price constraints, and that kept the prices low because it was harder for OPEC to go to China and say, we'll make up the difference with $100 oil when you're paying $50 for Russian oil.
And with, as far as I know, U.S. Strategic Reserve is also drawn down to a large degree. So that's another factor basically playing into the idea that if we have a black swan event, which in this case would be a truly black swan because you can't really forecast it.
That's right.
Because we don't know, then it might mean some incredibly high price for oil, right?
I think so. I mean, so there's a few events that I kind of outlined here that we can talk about that could be black swan events for oil. The first one, while we're on the topic, we might as well talk about China, which won't be a black swan event, actually. But let's talk about China. I mean, China has been in these, in this lockdown. And you mentioned that some of that rise in price in oil was because China's kind of coming out of the lockdowns and resuming.
They came out some time ago, like I think in the fall they started coming out, but they relaxed some of the restrictions on banks and reserve requirements and so on.
Exactly. And so you see an increase price and probably an increase in oil consumption from China. Now that data, as far as I can get, is pretty well delayed, but if we see here, I have a chart of it, and this is delayed. So that if somebody has better information, please share that with us. But here's what happened, going up into COVID, you saw this increase in China oil consumption. This is China oil consumption. Big increase followed by, the COVID initially, and then a rebound in it because China didn't have the, they kind of didn't lock down as much across the country. And then you see, what the effect of the lockdowns is. Now this ends at the end of 2022, Q4. So who knows what it's been doing
since.
Yeah,
you would think it was going up lately, for sure, for the last couple of months.
But if it just starts to go back up on this, trajectory, that's going to be a big increase in, right here, you're talking about 1 million barrels a day, just going back up to where it was in COVID. That's 1 million barrels a day. That takes up almost the entire cut. That essentially would make the cut that they just made of 1.5 million barrels equivalent to 2.5 million barrels, because you have another 2.5 million barrels coming in for the supply side of it. And if they continue that trajectory, that could be up to 15 million barrels a day and 16 million barrels a day at some point in the next few years. So they could be a big thing, but that's not going to be a black swan event, right? People can see this. This is data. So this is something that can really put pressure on oil prices, increasing them, assuming the rest of the global economy does not have a massive decrease in demand at the same time. So this is really, this is something that is a little more visible, a little more talked about, and a little more understandable by people in the marketplace, right? So that wouldn't be a black swan event, but it could certainly drive prices higher. This cut could make some pain.
So there are a lot of factors that could make sharp price moves in oil. You know, that I guess is the moral of the story. And then I think that there's also potential for a sharp move down potentially, because I think that people are misreading the Fed. People think that the Fed is done. I firmly believe that is far from the truth. I think the Fed will continue raising the rates. We will see. But you know, please write in the comments what you think. Don't forget to subscribe to the channel. We will do videos on oil or any topic. Suggest topics that you want, but we will cover the latest news and help you prepare your portfolio for extreme events, whether they're black swans or gray swans or green swans.
Yeah, next time we'll talk about green swans. Absolutely.
That's right. See you next time.
Thank you, everyone.